my fellow Twitter listeners, and welcome to yet another episode of Sex Talk. I'm your host, DJ.
Out and proud?
Well, I was going to say, DJ, the third hidden child of the tainted G.W. George Bush family.
that's a bit unwieldy.
I didn't know where I would go with that. I mean, you know.
Was he circumcised?
Could we just call you DJ Bush Bastard?
Well, you know, the thing is, the Florida Bush did top me once, but you can't really feel once it's in there whether it's circumcised or not.
Yeah.
It's dark.
Then who hasn't been topped by him, right?
Well, anyway, you were hidden in the bush, so who could see it?
That's right. In the barrel, in the bush, I just presented myself for mounting.
Baboon-like.
Wow. And in honor of both the Bush family, that proud family of Republicans whom I'm proud to
have had.
I'm proud to call.
Have used like a rented mule.
Of this great country. And National Coming Out Day, we have professor. Are you a professor?
Esteemed. We don't have to say it.
Okay, well.
Biathlon champion.
Esteemed, brilliant academic, certainly biathlon champion, as you point out. You have, your heart has 5 chambers rather than the usual human 4. I thought that was very interesting. So that gives you extra endurance. And also, feminist expert, I think, Faith Wilding.
Feminist expert.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Wow.
Anybody that's a woman on this show is a feminist expert. Because
oh, of course, yeah.
We have any women. are you, by the way, grading while we're doing this show?
I'm grading a paper right here.
That's very
hot off the press. Sent to me by a UN expert, as a matter
wow,
of fact.
Wow, really?
Yes. And I have a long email from him also, which I received, which has some very interesting information, which we might be able to get into later. But our topic
is that
for
the dirty email you're reading me earlier?
We'll see.
Wow. I can tell you used to do cartoon voiceovers before you became an academic.
Even while I'm an academic, yes. I could do Ickle Wee Floppet. Ickle Wee Floppet was this little dog who used to – invisible dog, of course. Used to ride on my arm.
Faith, this isn't a therapy session, right? Talk about your imaginary friends.
Really?
No, please, go ahead. Ickle Wee Floppet in your home. Are you not from the United States?
No.
Is this some kind of cartoon character from Belgium or wherever?
No, this is my own invention.
Oh.
Actually, he's from P.G. Wodehouse. You hadn't grown up on P.G. Wodehouse? Well, I'm British, so.
I read a great deal of P.G. Wodehouse, but I don't remember.
Oh, no, it wasn't. It was it was the boy's story. No, it was not.
Oh, boy. Smack me down with the literary reference, and it turns out you're wrong. Well, I hope you've learned a valuable little lesson here.
Well, this is his lesser known
so many of my brain
P.G.
cells
Wodehouse.
Have left me so that I cannot remember.
If it's not Harry Potter or Stroke Magazine, I haven't read it.
I haven't gotten
basically.
Into Harry Potter at all.
I haven't either,
actually. It's good.
Yeah, I hear it is. Yeah.
In fact, I had dinner tonight with a bunch of other
Potterites? Do they call them Potterites?
Potheads? I don't know.
Potheads.
And we ended up discussing Harry Potter.
Pot sherds.
Oh, boy.
So we have a horrible topic for tonight.
Well, it seems like, I mean.
It's the aesthetics of the vulva.
Yes.
Well, right? Or the anti-aesthetics of the vulva.
Are you
going
to be squicked by this, DJ?
I don't know. Well, I mean, are you uncomfortable? I mean, you know. I at least can remain an
Why should I be uncomfortable?
Well, you just said it was horrible. That wasn't my, you know.
Well.
Do you hate your own vulva?
Personally,
it sort of makes me flinch.
Way, so to speak.
What? Say that again.
Well, which part is the vulva? I mean, actually, I've never actually been.
Oh, well, you didn't come to our exhibition.
Yes, I did.
Really?
He was there at the opening,
just so to speak.
Did you reconstruct the vulva?
Just to give you a little clarification here, I was the only one brave enough to reconstruct it. I was talking with my co-host.
Oh, I have pictures of you doing that.
Do.
And you're going like, what is this
he
part?
He a beautiful vulva.
And I was stroking the clitoris afterwards.
Does this go in?
Yeah, and he was trying to put more than one clitoris. Which, for our listeners out there who weren't smart and or together and or out of their coma enough to go to the Miller Gallery, we should talk that Faith here is a member of the art group Sub Rosa. And they had basically half a floor to themselves at a recent art opening or art gallery show at the Miller Gallery here on the lovely, charming CMU campus. And part of it was a giant fabric vulva, which you could mix and match.
With little Velcro attachments.
Right, like you can add extra lips and hoods and clitori to your heart's content.
Clitori. Oh, that's we did have a double-pronged clitori.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. Like, are those real?
Well, who knows?
Do people
have
those?
possibly, everything's possible with the human body. See, that's the amazing thing about the human body. It comes in all shapes, sizes, and combinations.
I mean, that's
did you know that more than 10% of children are born sexually indeterminate?
No.
In some way? Oh, yeah.
You're making that up.
No.
So we're talking genetically, right, rather than physiologically.
Not just genetics.
I've heard this about genetics, that actually some surprising fraction of people are born.
Not just genetically, but also physically.
Jamie Lee Curtis style. That is
not necessarily evident right away in up to 10% of children. Well, and that there might be some gender dissonance, too, and that they might, for example, look like they're girls from the shape of their genitals, but, you know, they're
male identifying?
Well, but they have the, you know, they have the male
secondary
chromosome.
Traits. Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's like, you know, all kinds of possibilities. You know, all these mutations can happen. So it's very indeterminate often, you know, at the beginning. So this whole idea that, you know, that there are distinct, you know, male and female characteristics that you're born with that are absolute is actually sort of mythical. So, and it kind of goes to our theme, right, of people trying to change, constantly change the body in, you know, zillions of different ways, you know, by cutting and shaping and eating and running and exercising and, you know, accessorizing.
Right.
And de-accessorizing and siliconizing and all of that stuff. So, actually, in the exhibition, we also had a video that I made with Christina Hung, which was called Vulva Deconstructa, and it is about surgery on the female vulva,
elective cosmetic surgery
of the female vulva, yes. And so, in case you were wondering whether this is just something that people do because they are diseased or whatever. Doesn't seem to be the case at all. But there does seem to be a kind of aesthetics of the vulva that's implied in this kind of surgery. One place I went to look to research this, and you told me you did that too, Jeff.
Right.
Peking.
I merely do extensive background research on the show because I strive to be the best possible cyborg co-host that I can.
Excellent. The famous Dr. Matlock.
The amusingly named
Los Angeles,
Dr. Matlock, yeah.
From the Los Angeles Vaginal Rejuvenation Center.
That's what I found particularly interesting,
yes.
Right? That, like, he was selling this female genital cosmetic surgery as rejuvenation. And, you know, in my time, I have seen vulvas from, I guess, the age of 17 to 42, and they've all looked like, you know, they all look different, but I've never been able to tell an age difference here, so I was totally puzzled by this. Like,
so
when
presented with
like
a vulva without attached, you know, without seeing the rest of the body or the face.
Without obvious gray hairs.
You could not. Oh, yeah, the gray hairs. Now, that's a problem. That's a truly aesthetic problem that has been discussed by me and my friends quite a bit.
But it's certainly a less invasive change to make to merely dye your thatch than
take
a knife to the dangly
definitely
bits.
Well, do you want me to read a little,
please,
little
from
description from Dr. Matlock's site?
Who now owes us, I think, about 50 cents for all the mentions?
At least. Dr. Matlock does solve vulva-related crimes.
He does?
Yes.
This is his name, Dr. Matlock.
It's a great name, don't you think? It sounds like a Los Angeles detective. Anyway, from his wonderful site, it says, actually, I have a friend.
Keep going. You've missed my TV reference, which is right. Radio.
Right? The old TV detective.
You know, played by, what's his name?
You're right. That little craggy guy.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm kind of a little bit TV illiterate because I didn't grow up in this country and I didn't grow up with TV.
They make references to it all the time on The Simpsons, though.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, Grandpa.
Some episodes of that when I lived in Los Angeles.
Matlock or The Simpsons?
Matlock. Well, Simpsons is my favorite show.
Okay.
Just about. Besides South Park. And Sex and the City, of course. Anyway, aesthetic surgery.
Not really a favorite at all, then, is it? Anyway, I don't mean to.
Well, Sex and the City sucks.
If you're trying to
figure
out how to please me, and
really?
Our guests, too. Sex in the City.
See, I've never seen it.
You love Sex in the City?
Actually, I haven't watched it. All my idiot friends tell me to watch it. And, like, I usually ignore the first 10 or so recommendations, but now, like, the 11th idiot friend has told me to watch it. So I guess I have to watch it now because it's, like, good. But you don't think it's good?
It's horrendously annoying. You just want to slap those women until they're blue in the face.
Yeah, I mean, what's the premise, right? They're all, like, beautiful single women in New York City complaining.
In their late 30s, looking for men, basically. Mm. You know, and always finding the wrong ones. You know,
maybe
feeling sorry for themselves in the Manolo Blahnik shoes.
I think they should come to a TG to really understand human pity.
Yeah, I think so, too. Anyway, back to aesthetics of the vulva. Aesthetic surgery of the female external genitalia has been neglected by physicians, it says, on Dr. Matlock's site. However, awareness of female genital aesthetics has increased. Mm. You see? Mm-hmm. So there is a female genital aesthetics, according to this site. Owing to increased media attention to
media
the vulva,
attention.
Right?
I guess
from
that
magazines
means,
and
that
video.
Means porn, right?
Probably. It's those Bieber shots, you know?
Everyone wants to look like Jenna's vulva, I guess.
So it says women may feel self-conscious about the appearance of their labia majora. Do you know what that is, DJ?
Well, because I went to Catholic school for 14 years, it means the big lips.
The big lips. Very good. Or more commonly, labia minora.
Mm. Those are the big boobies?
It's not the Madonna with the big boobies.
Those are these smaller
That was
ones.
A different show. The aging female, here you go, Jeff, may dislike the descent of her pubic hair.
Descent?
That's what it
What's
says.
What's that mean? Does it mean like slowly
know.
The piece around towards the butt?
I don't know.
Whoa.
It says the descent of the pubic hair and the labia are going to descend, probably down to the knees.
Oh, yeah.
And may desire re-elevation to its previous location.
Hmm. You know, if I wasn't gay before this show, I'd certainly be gay afterwards.
Just wait till you see the pictures.
And it says very few physicians are concerned with the appearance of the female external genitalia. A relative complacency exists that frustrates many women. Now, this is complete crap, right? We understand this. This is completely made up by this guy so that he'll have a practice.
Oh, this is Dr. Matlock's point of view.
This is Dr. Matlock's point of view.
I think you're a little blocked.
He's doing
here,
it all for the children, you can tell.
Really, I'm not allowed to say crap?
No, I think you're a little blocked, I said. Maybe
blocked?
Yeah, because...
Maybe you need some therapy.
I'm worried about... Here there are women with genuine concerns about the appearance of their vulva, and you're just smacking them down.
And they're like 19. I mean,
19?
I looked at a lot of the women who are on his site who are giving glowing testimonials, and also, you know, he has examples on his site of, you know, this is a 19-year-old female or a 22-year-old female who came in with slight irregularity of one of the lips. You know, one lip was bigger than the other, you know. So this is what we were able to do, and there's before and after pictures, right? So, I mean,
I missed that part of the site.
All of the – you didn't get to the images?
That's because I don't have an adult check membership. Perhaps I need
– No? You
wow.
just need to know where to find them.
I guess so.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at these shapes and everything, and you go, like, these are, like, really young women. You know, they're plump, juicy women. And, like, what's the problem?
Hmm.
But you said before, Jeff, that symmetry seems to be...
Who is this,
you know,
Jeff person of which you speak?
Who?
I am Dr. Sexopolis.
Jimmy D. Oh, Dr. who?
Sexopolis.
Sexopolis. Ooh. Okay.
He gets a lot more respect with that name than Jeff.
Okay, Dr. Sexopolis. you were saying, you know, that symmetry seems to be a very important criteria,
well,
right?
No. I wasn't saying that. What I was... Earlier, I was talking with our lovely and charming guest, and I mentioned that... I was kind of befuddled by this whole site, this whole Dr. Matlock site, because, like as I've said earlier, like, you know, vulvas are all different, but I've never been able to extract any kind of aesthetic of the female external genitalia,
right.
Despite my regrettably small acquaintance thereof. But
now, Mr. Sexologist.
The only thing I could possibly come up with, and if I were forced to start to make – construct some aesthetic theory would be symmetry, because that's a very common characteristic of all, like, human aesthetics, right? Like,
right.
You want your boobs the same size and the same shape. You want your face to be evenly shaped and symmetric. You want your arms to be the same length, eyes the same color, so forth. But, you know, that's – and I was saying if I was a Martian coming to, you know, coming to planet Earth to evaluate things, like, that would be kind of the first cut I would make, so to speak.
First cut.
Symmetry seems to be important to us.
Yeah.
But beyond that, like, I have no idea.
Yeah. I was
saying short hair is good, too, purely for navigational purposes.
Yeah, but that's not surgery.
Right? No, not at all. That's a pair of scissors and a mirror or whatever.
Scissors, razor blades, whatever.
Owie.
But
razor burn.
But, you know, actual cutting, right?
Right,
Of tissue that is not sick, is not, you know, is not disturbing
anybody. But that's the whole meaning of elective, though, right?
So. Well, there you go. I mean, elective. What does that mean in a culture where women are now supposed to be anxious about how their vulvas look? Okay. You know, after everything else, I mean, there's no territory that's left anymore. So,
well,
of course,
perhaps this is just revenge, right? Because men have been concerned about how their penises look for the last 15,000 years. So,
yeah, which is just like, you know, sad. Because
the ultimate equality of the sexes. Everyone
well,
is equally
men are
insecure.
having penis operations too. Of course.
Oh yeah.
You know,
yep.
but mostly just for mostly to make them bigger.
Yep.
Or to make them, you know, more potent, fatter, rounder.
Right.
So you know, there's things that can be done.
Yeah, with varying levels of amusing failure too.
Like, yeah, but the operations on the women, so far as I can tell, is actually to reduce the size. That seems to be
the biggest,
you know, preoccupation is that they're too big, they're irregular, they hang down, they might be drawn inside during intercourse, which would be very uncomfortable. You know,
they might get
in the way of horseback riding, stuff like that.
Wow, that'd have to be awful big.
I know, it's like hanging down to your knees, right? So I mean, it's really interesting how this operation is all about reducing the size.
Right,
you know, it's like, you know, women who are supposed to have a lack anyway because they don't have a penis, right?
Right.
So now the lack is getting operated on.
That is interesting, right? Like, just purely from this kind of cultural criticism standpoint, right? Where the cosmetic surgery men are having to their penis is to make it bigger.
Exactly.
Where with women, it's supposed to make everything smaller.
Yeah, and make it even more – and make it really tight. You know, this idea of rejuvenation.
Right.
You know, and people who are really young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's part of the whole plastic surgery industry is rejuvenation.
Right.
Is like, you know, an enhancement. Those two words, rejuvenation and enhancement. And the testimonials on the site, I don't know if you saw any of those testimonials.
Mm-mm, no.
There's a Boston doctor, too, who's got an even funnier name, which I can't remember right now. Starts with an M, too.
Dr. Quincy?
No, it wasn't Quincy.
Dr. Quinn?
Quinn. Quim.
Can we say that? I guess we just
yeah, because no American will know what we're talking about except some person who's studied Old English or something, you know, or Victorian pornography.
Speaking of idiot Americans, I suppose we should give the phone number.
Oh, yeah.
Is that my job?
In case we want Vox Pops.
Are you Dr. Faith Wilding or are you just Faith
No,
Wilding?
I'm just an MFA. Mighty fine artist.
If you have questions, comments, or concerns to share with.
Master Faith.
Yes, and I can help you redesign your vulva because I'm a very good artist, and you know, I already redesigned one vulva, so.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Well, so have you.
Get your pencils out.
Yeah, get your pencils.
The phone number is 621-9728. On campus, it is 89728. Now that I've got a word in edgewise, I'm going to ask you a question, which is, I want you to key off of the idea that you were saying, well, gee, isn't it strange that 19-year-olds are getting their vulvas redesigned, but in fact, aren't 19-year-olds having all kinds of plastic surgery for the same kind of, you know, absurd aesthetic reasons, especially in L.A., which is kind of the world headquarters for that kind of behavior?
Not at all the world headquarters, actually, if I may. Well, actually, South America.
Again,
Japan and South America.
South America,
for example.
Yeah, in fact, a friend of mine, Heidi, was telling me that, what is it? Is it Venezuela that, like, has the highest rate of female cosmetic surgery in the world? But interestingly, it's all about breast reduction and butt enhancement down there.
Yeah. Really?
Like, they want small boobs, big butts.
Well, it's the Southern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
Exactly. Brazil, same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
in fact, there was recently, I think, a no plastic surgery clause added to the Miss Venezuela competition because every woman in there had like, extensive mannequin-like plastic surgery done on her.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway.
And it's a lot cheaper there, you know, and people go down there to have it done. But teenagers here, nose jobs, I mean, are like
16th birthday gift.
Exactly.
Yeah.
One of the most common things. Boob jobs, nose jobs, you know, and then you go with the tummy tucks and the butt things and the liposuction and all of that stuff, you know, which is actually very dangerous, liposuction. You know, none of these things are without, you know, harm at all because, you know, anything that requires an anesthetic or that requires cutting or, you know, cutting blood vessels and stuff like that, I mean, you know, can lay you open to infections.
So, to play the devil's advocate here for a moment, the common retort that's given or the response to given is like, well, doctors have for centuries, if not millennia, have been concerned with saving human life. Now cosmetic surgeons are concerned with enhancing the quality of human life, right? Like, who are we or who are feminist scholars to say, oh, you can't do that. That is a bad thing to get done to your body, to get some fat sucked out, to get a butt tuck, to get a boob enhancement or dehancement or whatever. Like, aren't these ultimately personal choices, aren't they? Personal choices about quality of life. And isn't that important also?
And to box you in even further, you know.
Oh, box me in.
But, you know, plastic surgeons, I mean, everybody is pretty much universal agreement that people who are disfigured, people are all for plastic surgery to restore a normal human appearance. So
yes, the classic, you know, reconstructive in the cosmetic reconstructive surgery degree.
Yeah.
So what's wrong with an army of futuristic mannequins that all look the same in our...
Well, that's of course, you know, the question. I mean, you know, of course, nobody can tell anybody else what to do, and, you know, but we can critique the effects of it. And, you know, you mentioned the word normal, and I think that's one of the biggest things is this normalization, you know, and this, which is the same thing that fuels the diet industry and everything else, you know, is this idea that there is an ideal, that there is an aesthetics, and that if you achieve that, you will be desirable and you will have a happy life, you know, which goes to your question that, you know, that plastic surgery will enhance your life, will make you feel better, and a lot of women say it does. And who am I to say it doesn't? But, you know, as a feminist, I also have to question whether, you know, this is a good thing that people... if they try to achieve these ideals that are held out for them by the society, if that makes them happy, it just doesn't seem like a very, you know, wonderful goal to me. I mean, it seems like, you know, a very oppressive kind of thing to try to be normalized and try to reach ideals, you know, which are you know, set for completely, you know, meaningless reasons, really. You know.
Yeah, but isn't kind of all aesthetics meaningless, right? Like once you can sit on that chair, is there any more meaning added?
The interesting thing about aesthetics is that each person has their own aesthetics, really, and that's constantly in kind of struggle with, you know, what seems to be the normative aesthetics, you know, and causes enormous kind of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're looking at your body and you're saying, well, you know, I'm kind of friends with my body, I kind of like it, you know, and it's mine, you know. But then you compare it to what the ideal is, and you see that it's not like that, and so I'm not supposed to like it. You know, it sets up this enormous kind of conflict, you know, which in very young people who don't, you know, have much of a sense of self yet, you know, sends them to binge, you know, dieting and vomiting and, you know, anorexia and all kinds of stuff, you know, and cutting their bodies. Mm-hmm. When they're really young. I mean, the dangerous thing about starting plastic surgery when you're that young is that you have to redo it then.
Yeah.
And, you know, the plastic surgeons tell you, you know, if you start at 30, you have to keep up. You know, you have to keep redoing it because, you know, the body changes and the elasticity of skin changes and it looks really bad. And it looks worse even, apparently, if you've had plastic surgery, you know, when you're pretty young and then you don't keep it up. So it's like, you know, you get into a sort of never-ending cycle of it.
Here's a little factoid which I didn't know until recently, was that breast enhancement surgery, boob jobs, have to be redone every few years.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't realize that.
Exactly.
I thought it was like a one-time shot, but no, like it's – I learned from Jenny McCarthy, actually, on the Howard Stern show.
Oh, yeah. Well, she would know.
She would know, although she kept it secret for a long time because she didn't want her dad to know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of social and sort of political factors. And to me, it also goes to this whole issue that I'm very interested in, which is like the medicalization of women's bodies and, you know, the increased medicalization of all of women's, you know, processes from, you know, the new reproductive technologies to menopause to, you know, aging and rejuvenation therapies for aging people. And, you know, everything is medicalized now. Everything is a medical problem, you know, from pregnancy to, you know, things that used to be thought of as completely normal and natural things. You know, everything has now been medicalized and has become the territory of the control of experts. You know, just like the plastic surgeons are now the experts on how we should look, you know. So I think it's, you know, more and more... you know, the reason I'm concerned about it is because it's a form of social control. It's another form of controlling, you know, women and men, because a lot of men are now doing plastic surgery also, particularly older men who feel that they can't compete anymore in today's, right, you know, high-pressure society. So they're having, you know, now they have the same problems that women have always had.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, there was a New Yorker cartoon I saw recently which struck home. This man looking through basically a men's health type thing in this cartoon and asking his friend, when did men become women? Which is very true. Like, if you look at men's health, which actually is primarily for gay men, but it's like, or any number of one of these other men's magazines, it's all about, like, your abs, your penis, your sex life, which is, you know, the isomorphism of cosmos, your boobs, your sex life, your diet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'm wondering if there's any listeners out there who have any opinions about female genitalia and how they should look. And because, I mean, to me, again, you know, the reason why I'm disturbed about this plastic surgery too, this, I think we should call it aesthetic surgery, actually, which is what they call it, is that... gosh, I've lost my train of thought. I mean, it doesn't do a thing for the vulva to be chopped up. It just creates a lot of scar tissue, and you're cutting off a lot of soft tissue that has a lot of nerve ends and blood vessels in it. And so you're actually, I think you're actually depriving yourself of touch experiences, and you know, and there's absolutely no proof that this improves your sexual sensation.
Right.
You know, which, why do it? If it doesn't do that, my God, you know. I mean, that is, and in my article that I wrote about all of this, which is called Vulvas with a Difference, I actually compare the practices of female genital mutilation, particularly in many countries of Africa, with which is an enforced cutting and mutilation of the vulva, which is much worse.
Yeah.
It seems to me than what
that comparison might be a little bit unfair, right?
I'm only comparing it in the way in which it works as social control of women and women's bodies.
There's more of a difference between trimming your nails and cutting your hand off.
But it's a really interesting comparison to make, I think, because supposedly in the first world countries it's elective and it's for pleasure, and in Africa and in the countries where it's enforced as a ritual practice, it's, you know, supposedly...
It's very colonial.
It's very colonial. It kills the women's pleasure, and, you know, it's just the opposite, and yet it's a practice that, you know... has been very, very hard to eradicate and cannot be eradicated.
Just as a side note, one of the other interesting things I saw on Dr. Matlock's site was hymen reconstruction.
Yes.
Right? Because he said, you know, something about, like, well, you know, in the modern world, like, thanks to sports and horseback riding and running and so forth, the hymen just doesn't exist basically anymore.
Exactly.
Past a certain age, let alone through sex. And he said, but, you know, some cultures, some countries,
especially
require
a lot of our ethnic customers,
right,
require,
you know, require a sign of blood on the sheets the first wedding night to show she's a virgin. And they
so
we
reconstruct the hymen. Also, some of the aesthetic surgeons have been asked to actually try to reconstruct women who've been you know, have come from Africa and have had the genital mutilation done to them, and somehow to help them and reconstruct them, because often they're extremely mutilated and have terrible, painful, you know, infections and, you know, horrible things. And
how are you feeling over there, DJ?
He's fainting.
For you. I've got numerous questions for you. I'm waiting for a chance to get them in.
Oh, I'll shut up, and you can ask.
But, you know, the show's all about you.
No, it's not. It's not about me. It's about vulvas.
I thought you were
going to
strip down later.
I forgot to send you that email, right?
But oh, you did.
Thanks to Fat Mandy.
Well, if you guys will strip, I'll strip too.
Don't think I won't take you up on that offer. These clothes have like Velcro. They'll come right off. So I had sort of three questions. The first was, you know, you made this comment about the medicalization of women, and I think there's a lot of validity there, but isn't it a little bit overstated? Because after all, some of these things, for example, certainly the fertility treatment is for the woman's benefit primarily. I mean, if someone who wants a child who can't biologically have her own child, that's all for her. And then we're not, you know, true or false, but presumably it's arguably making more opportunities available for women, not less. Also, in the same way, the menopause thing, yes, it's a natural process, but, I mean, some women really suffer through menopause. I mean, it drives them crazy. They just cannot even function rationally anymore. I mean, it's really intense emotionally for them.
Well, why should they function rationally? Why can't they just go off their heads, you know, while the hormones rage or whatever, you know?
Sure, but
it goes to a normalization thing, right?
Yeah, but I mean, some women...
You have to behave in certain ways.
Well, I mean, come on, but some women, it's really a priority. CEO of Hewlett Packard is a woman. If she can't function...
I'm kind of going a little to the edge here with this because... you know, because these are all of the arguments, of course, that drive a tremendously profitable industry, right?
Indeed.
You know, which has over-medicalized everybody in this country. Everybody in this country, you know, lives off drugs, basically, you know, and the pharmacy industry is getting incredibly rich off women, you know, who are having hot flashes and being, you know, having insomnia.
Right. So, but I think you can make arguments on both sides. I mean, the drug industry has also improved the lives of millions. By their own, you know, estimation, the drug companies have improved their
absolutely.
Lives.
And I like drugs, too.
And the second question is, I was wondering if you want to make a distinction between, I think, the sort of very valid social programming of young women who haven't fully, you know, established their own persona and their own will, and someone who's, say, you know, a 35-year-old woman who's arguably perfectly able to make her own choices about and it's not appropriate. So, you know, I think we'd agree there that, you know, 13-year-olds should not be receiving images about how their bodies are fat or their vulvas are misshapen, but 35-year-olds may have the right to, you know, in some sense, the moral right to...
So unfortunately, that's true.
Yeah, you know, I just to spring the defense of Faith here for a moment, I don't think she's saying... you know, these women don't have the right to do this, but more like questioning, like, the whole aestheticization of the vulva now. Like, this is, you know, as I've said myself, like, this is kind of surprising to me. Like, as a heterosexual male, I had no idea, like, that I might have been seeing ugly vulvas. Like, I feel...
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the vulva thing is, I think, an unusually clear point because, you know, clearly the person... I mean, you can't even look at your own vulva without tools. So clearly the person that this is
it's
for...
It's hard, yeah, unless you're really, really, you know, limber.
Right. So the person this is really for is the partner, and for most women, the partner is a man.
Exactly.
And so the argument that it's really for the sort of the man...
You know, and no man who's ever seen mine... or handled it, has ever said to me, oh, this is really ugly here, you know. In fact, it's just like the opposite, right? So, you know, so where does these ideas come from? You know, it's like ridiculous. You know, I mean, it's a manufactured problem, right? Except for perhaps some exceptions, you know, which are truly anomalous, you know, which may be problematic in one way or another. But the examples that I saw on the website were like, nothing. You know?
Well, you know, of course, they're not going to show the extreme, what you might call, quote, deserving examples, because then ordinary women would look at and say, well, I don't have one vulva 25 inches long, one lip 25 inches long, the other one normal, therefore I don't need this. What they're going to show is women who are normal, as normal, if not more normal than
but
they
could
are.
Be more beautiful.
Right.
You know, meaning.
Because they'll say, well, good God, if Cindy Crawford needs to diet, then my fat butt certainly needs to. You know,
yeah,
it's the same
exactly.
thing if.
Yeah, really good point, Dr.
This dewy 19-year-old needs female genital cosmetic hoo-ha, then
exactly.
my ancient, creaky 15, you know, 25-year-old self does.
Yeah, exactly.
So my third question, which is a little more compelling, is I thought, so here we're talking about these women in parts of Africa who are going through this, and there's all kinds of cultural pressures. I mean, they're, you know, often it's their mothers making the daughters do it. The daughters are talked into it. There's all kinds of horrible pressure. I mean, you can't, you know, no single person can say, I really don't want to do this. This is gross because the whole...
Your mom drags you to the clinic and forces you to marry.
Clinic. You're lucky if you get dragged to the clinic.
The stone, right?
But, I mean, you know, even if you don't want it to happen, you're not going to... I mean, your whole life is kind of dependent on this. You're not going to find an appropriate
mate. Yeah, because that's the way it's become mythologized and naturalized, you know, within the culture.
And so you were talking about... So what's the way out of here? You were talking earlier about there's some kind of UN resolution.
Oh, yeah. I happen to have here with me, hot off the press, from the UN... I showed this video on the vulva in Austria, and I immediately some university professor in Berlin started writing to me who was on this UN commission.
That must be anti-stalking laws.
it's the manual for the new strategy against female genital mutilation. And just to sum it up for our listeners, they decided.
Well, you might want to discuss the old strategies, as you were telling me earlier, right?
Oh, what the process?
So also, just for because many of our listeners out there are CMU students and probably have no idea
what
the vulva is, right?
Like, oh, the vulva.
Or anything. Or the clitoris, indeed.
It's listener or not listener.
Right. Our listener, Bo.
Only one listener.
You might want to discuss what this ugly-sounding but so far nebulously defined female genital mutilation actually is.
Oh, yes.
And before you do any of that, I'm going to say, if you want to call in, 621-9728. I'll say it again, 621-9728.
Okay. There's three or four different degrees of this kind of circumcision, and circumcision is really a misnomer because it's not just the removal of a little bit of skin, but the most radical and the most often done one, by the way, is the removal of the entire clitoris. And
so even in sympathy, I'm kind of going fetal.
I know.
Here.
Me too. I've got my legs very tightly wedged together. Nobody's getting in there right now with a knife. And then the smaller lips are usually cut off also, and the whole thing is stitched together and often held together just like with thorns and things, and just a very small opening left for the menstrual blood and for the urine. And, of course, it's excruciating. It's done without anesthesia. It's usually traditionally done by old women who are the circumcisers who do it with, like, rusty knives, rusty razor blades. Yeah, and the infection rate is incredible, and scarring, you know, and then the girls have to sort of tie their legs together, and they let them lie there for like a couple of weeks to like heal.
Good God.
You know, and the scarring is really incredible. I mean, if you want to read some pretty good, if you read Alice Walker's book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, it's all about female circumcision and trying to trace it back. How did this custom originate? And Dr. Sexopolis and I were discussing this previously, that this is probably not a very ancient custom, but that it's a kind of colonizing custom in terms of Muslim kind of infiltration into regions of Africa, right, that, you know, and bringing with them certain practices or originating practices there to control the locals. And possibly, you know, female sexuality was one of the things that must have really come up against, you know, Muslim practices, you know, a very different kind of treatment of sexuality. You could see where it could be something that, although I don't know this to be true necessarily, it could have been something instituted as a way of controlling the local population.
For once, an evil that Christianity wasn't responsible for. That's refreshing.
No, but Christianity did pretty bad things too, almost as bad things. So anyway, this very radical kind of cutting off of, you know, the clitoris and the smaller lips and often even scraping out the larger lips, and so that actually what remains, and I have pictures here which you guys can't see, your listeners can't see.
But I'm sure your imagination is sketching vivid details.
A little slit, you know, with heavily scarred, which has to be, excuse me, ripped open in the first intercourse of the marriage. And, so it's all around nasty, right? And now they're proposing that since it seems to be absolutely necessary to have some kind of ritual that involves blood and that involves the clitoris, that they would just make a very small...
So if I can interrupt, you were telling me earlier that the UN originally was like saying, we have to ban this, right?
We have to ban this, and that didn't work because it would just go underground. Or right, we have like, to legalize it,
right,
so it just gets done in hospitals. But then it continues the practice, right? And most people can't afford hospitals, and so, you know, nothing happens. And all of their strategies have been unsuccessful, including this one.
And so there's this new one now, which is
this
kind of
new
like,
one,
well,
which
we'll
has
cut
now
it
been
a
tried
little bit
in Kenya and a couple of test regions for about a year. And it's just the suggestion is just to make a little cut in the skin, the prepuce that covers the clitoris. And this solves a little problem which many women seem to have and which they didn't even know about, which is that the clitoris, when it gets erect, sometimes gets caught under that hood, and that could be really bad because then you can't find it. You know, most men can't find the clitoris anyway.
Right. I think there should be the next round of, you know, genetic modifications as a human should be like a big red light on women's foreheads.
Exactly.
Like, so when you touch the clitoris, it lights up.
No,
so then you know.
Or else you just move the clitoris to the forehead.
Yeah.
Or put it between the breasts.
Right, right.
That would be a really good
guys certainly
good
know
place.
How to find those. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
It's like, here it is! So anyway, I just got an email from this guy saying, you know, we've been trying this and it's not working. Nobody wants to do it. The women are insisting on continuing to be cut. And here's an interesting thing. He said, only a few days ago I learned of an experiment carried out in Somalia. They showed a film to elderly men about what is really happening during the so-called circumcision. And these men were shocked. They said, we cannot let this happen to our girls, which is, you know, really weird. And he says that the ritual that they're trying, the sort of milder ritual, is just to cut off the tip of the clitoris. Now, the clitoris is very small, right?
Yeah.
And most people can't find it and see it anyway. And cutting off the tip, you can't see that it's cut off. So, you know, I mean, how can you justify a ritual, you know, that can't isn't even visible, right? But that actually does lose a lot of sensation. So there's a lot of, you know, he's theorizing it as a kind of sacrifice. He's saying what it is, it's a ritual sacrifice, that women are sacrificing something that is very precious to them, and so, you know, which is what sacrifice is supposed to be. You're supposed to sacrifice something that's really precious.
Right,
to
but
you,
you're
right?
also supposed to be willing when you – otherwise
yeah.
it's not
well,
a sacrifice
exactly.
so much
like,
as insult and battery,
them,
right? Yeah.
It usually is done to, like – 4 to 6 year old girls.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I was mentioning earlier, like part of this book that I was shown recently, like Gynecology was.
Yeah, Mary Daly's book.
Right,
yeah.
talks about this, how it's a practice on women, but perpetuated by women. It's
exactly.
Women from the town or whatever that drag the little girl screaming off to the clitoridectomyologist.
Well, I mean, it's a, you know, Foucault talks about this, you know, that we incorporate our own oppression, you know, and our own discipline
that
and
Wiley
structures,
Michelle.
You know. And so, you know, I wouldn't think that this kind of ritual on a mass level would have been done, would have been started by women voluntarily. I mean, we do hear of the priests of Adonis, mm-hmm. not the priests of Adonis, the priests of Aphrodite who used to castrate themselves
yes.
in a frenzy during mm-hmm. an orgy and fling their organs onto the, you know, the
right.
burning pyre or something, you know. And there's a whole practice of eunuchs and so on,
right.
you know, which is
there's doubt that those priests of Aphrodite, the servants of Aphrodite, actually ever
it
did
makes
that.
Makes a great story.
It makes a great story, right?
Stories.
But
he's
yeah.
squirming again over here. I think he's not quite up to this topic.
Well, you have a
let's
whole
have
team
a joke.
Of,
let's
have
a joke.
You have a whole team of. post-pubescent eunuchs at home to serve you, right? You must have an opinion on this.
We all should have it. Except, you know, I mean, if they're eunuchs.
Right, I mean, I actually kind of wonder whether I'm not the post-pubescent eunuch. I had a tangential question, but I didn't want to torture you with this tangential question because it's really bad. I was just saying, when you said Mary Daly, I wasn't like, oh, wasn't she like the Boston University mm-hmm. professor who was like, fired because
yep.
she wouldn't let a male student attend
oh, that's right.
class with the women.
She was a very strong separatist lesbian, definitely.
Do you happen to know how that was resolved? I remember reading about the case, but I don't remember if she
I think she eventually won it because I think she's still teaching there.
Really?
Yeah. Boston College, which is very, very conservative. Or Boston University, which is very, very...
I don't remember.
It wasn't Boston University?
It was Boston University or Boston College, but I don't remember.
I think it was Boston College, because Boston College is actually Catholic, right? And I remember...
It could be, yeah. And she was teaching theology, you know, feminist theology.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to imagine her sort of winning that case. I'm wondering if she backed down or, I mean...
Well, I mean... In those days, this was a long time ago.
No, this was a couple years ago.
Really?
This last round, yeah. I remember reading about it when it was hot off the presses. There was a guy who wanted to take one of her women's studies classes, and she wouldn't let him.
Oh.
And he, you know, basically went to the top, went to the president, who insisted that she take a male student. And
she was willing to tutor him privately, if I recall correctly, but not
right.
in the same class.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting issue, the whole separatist issue, you know, because we used to do women's studies classes and insist on separatism, you know, in the 70s, in the early 70s, and that was okay. But it's probably, you know, against all of the rules now because equal opportunity has been, you know, redefined in such a, you know, in such a far-reaching way that mm-hmm. keeps us all under total control, you know, including having to, you know, have students in our classes who are not capable even of sitting in a class.
Ayn Rand is spinning in her grave.
On drugs or whatever, you know. I mean, it's gone, like, really far.
I mean, which side of that, I'm actually interested, this is a bit of a tangent, but which side of this issue do you actually fall on? Because I think it's...
To cut or not to cut, you mean?
No, I mean to exclude a male student or not to exclude a male student who, you know, all the things being equal, he's qualified, eager, whatever. I mean, so he qualifies as a student, but you just don't want the male presence in a female classroom. Are you for the sort of separate but equal?
Is there any case when?
I mean, I have taught separatist classes, but that was a long time ago, and it doesn't seem. I don't know what I would do exactly if the problem arose. I haven't encountered it for a long time. When I taught feminist art class at CMU, I had two guys in the class, and everybody seemed okay with it, you know. And they sometimes had to sit there and listen to some pretty heavy duty stuff, you know. And not that it was all anti-male or anything, but you know. I think it's a very good learning experience for men to be in the minority sometimes, you know, in a class like that.
Right, and you know, it's interesting. Like, if this is okay, is to exclude men, is it ever okay to do the opposite? Right, to have a class that's men only? Could you have a Robert Bly seminar where you don't allow women in, you know, because it's all about the penis?
Who would want to take that class? The Robert Bly drumming
frat
in the
guys,
woods.
The brain damage.
Yeah. Actually, a lot
simple
of
crustaceans,
there's a lot of de facto segregation, you know, male-female segregation. I mean, there's a lot of classes that are taught at CMU that you'll see no women in, or maybe
I think CMU is a bad example because you're so few women to begin with, right?
So, I mean,
women would have to take 10 classes a semester in order to have a presence in every class.
I mean, that's a serious problem, but that's a different problem. And the problem is girls being socialized since they were high schoolers or younger not to quite – think they can do math and science.
Math is hard.
Exactly. Yeah.
Says Barbara.
But there's also a really strong male culture in those departments, which does exclude women.
Yes.
You know, and they don't get it. They keep saying, you know, why do we only have 10% or less women in computer science and so on? Well, it's such a strong male culture, you know.
I think CMU is an excellent example of this because they had, you know, a project to increase, and a very successful project to increase the women in computer science. In the past few years, and their numbers have been extraordinary. But I mean, so
and although they have been declining recently,
really?
Yeah,
I think they peaked in like 96 or 97.
Yeah, and they're worried again. They're worried, and they're actively trying to think about what to do. But nobody ever says, "Well, maybe it's because there's a real strong male culture, and maybe we need to do something really, you know, affirmative here, and do like, you know, a really kind of affirmative, kind of feminist, you know, or woman-centered thing here, you know."
Although, as just a side note, it's a tangent to your tangent. So, a friend of mine. A woman was on the admissions committee for the computer science graduate school for quite a while. And basically she said if you kind of graph, let's call it like GRE scores or grade point average and grade point average together, right, you'll have you can graph all the students on this, like it's a cluster of points. And, you know, the ones that are the furthest out are the best, and you accept those first. And then you wait to see who rejects, and then you accept the closer ones in. And she's actually saying almost all of the people they accept first are women. But there are no women anywhere else in the category. It's only the most qualified students that are women. And she said, so there's this – it's not even so much that CMU, the graduate program of computer science, has this male culture that's excluding women. It happens well before then.
Mm-hmm.
You said it could be
–
she said there are two reasons. One is it could be many – you know, women just don't see a career in computer science for themselves and therefore don't pursue the graduate degree. Or it could be also this issue of women – won't apply to graduate school unless they're positive they're going to get in, right? So you only get the hyper-qualified women applying to CMU because they're positive they'll get in. And women who would get in ordinarily if they applied don't because they don't think they will.
Yeah, and both of which things are totally gender, you know, gender role things.
Right.
But
anyway, to get back to
gender education.
You're looking at me funny, DJ Bushbottom.
We didn't get any callers. Nobody wanted to talk about the vulva.
That's because we're fascinating.
We didn't allow them to call.
We've done studies, and sometimes our callers go into such a state of information overload.
Really?
Catatonia.
Yeah.
They're so fascinated that they can't even go to the phone because they're afraid they might miss something.
It's a lot like Max Headroom, you know, Blitbert.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, our sheer radio presence is so powerful.
So, you know, just to wrap it up, so to speak, I, you know, I don't think it's really so much a question of am I for or against. I think, you know, we really need to look at what's driving all of this. You know, and in America, it's definitely money, right? And
right.
It's this kind of, you know, it's this kind of social pressure.
And I guess you could say it's not a money thing, but there's a social pressure in for female genital mutilation, too, like we're talking.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
And
I mean, yeah.
But
else would drive that? Because it's like, you know.
Is it painful?
It's so nasty.
Is it an aesthetic thing, though, I guess? You know, I'm trying to make the lame final minute of the show wrap up
with all the themes, right?
Are they both aesthetic decisions?
I don't think it's really aesthetic so much, although they talk about clean and cleaning and so on.
Right.
But I think there it's about fear. You know, somewhere way back there was terrible fear of female sexuality, and that's when that was instituted to curb it.
Faith, we got about 60 seconds left. We have a caller. So,
caller.
Finally.
A caller in our final few seconds. Hello, is the caller on the air?
Hi.
Thanks for calling in.
Okay.
Did you have a question or comment or concern to share with Faith and the rest of us?
I'm listening to what the person you're interviewing is saying, kind of about everything being controlled by money and power. That's a really dominant view in feministic culture, and I dispute it. I don't think it's real.
How so?
I think there are more issues at play here besides just the issue of powers and incentives. I think there are ideological issues.
Cut to the chase because we have to get off the air.
We have 15 seconds left.
Ideological?
Okay. I think there are physiological issues. I think they're evolutionarily pre-programmed and preconditioned issues. I think there are many more issues than are being looked at by feministic culture, and I think in general it's more one-sided.
Wow.
Well, we didn't get into very complex, you know,
evolutionary biological.
We really kind of skimmed the top here today. So, I think you're absolutely right. It's way more complex, but
it's not just more. It's more than just doctors wanting to make money. It's more than just magazine publishers.
But what drives that, and so on and so forth. But basically, it's all money and power.
we have to go. It's midnight. Thank the caller for calling in. Maybe we're going to have you back, Faith, to talk about these other issues. Like, we're not really giving that particular question any kind of fair treatment.
No, we're not. That's true.
This is WRCT Pittsburgh. Thanks for calling in. Tune in next time, Tuesday at 11. Sextalk.wrct.org is the website.